Welcome to Real Truth for Today with Pastor Jeff Shreve, Senior Pastor of First Baptist Church in Texarkana, Texas. Now, here's Pastor Jeff.
Well, good morning and welcome to Real Truth for Today. Pastor Jeff Shreve here. It is Wednesday, May 21st. Hope you're having a great morning. 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 14 and following. But even if you should suffer for the sake of righteousness, you are blessed. And do not fear their intimidation, and do not be troubled, but sanctify Christ. Set him apart as Lord in your hearts, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you, yet with gentleness and reverence, and keep a good conscience, so that in the thing in which you're slandered, those who revile your good behavior in Christ may be put to shame. Well, I'm holding in my hands the brand new book, Apologetics for an Ever-Changing Culture. Dr. Sean McDowell is the general editor. It's 23 authors. The subtitle is A Biblical and Culturally Relevant Approach to Talking About God. Now, Sean McDowell is the son of Josh McDowell. Josh McDowell, the very, very famous apologist, and Sean is following in his dad's footsteps. He's got a PhD in apologetics and worldview studies from Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky, internationally recognized speaker, author of numerous books, and the host of Think Biblically podcast. Sean explores the biggest questions about God, morality, and contemporary culture. Sean, welcome to the program today.
Pastor Jeff, thanks for having me. This is a treat.
Well, I hope I got everything in there. Oh, I did forget, you're associate professor in Biola's University Christian Apologetics program. You're a busy guy.
You know what? I've got a lot of help in each one of those that helps me delegate.
Well, I think I might have told you this, Sean. The first time I met you, I think you were about 4 years old. Your dad came to the University of Texas. I was a student there. And you were with him on one of his speaking trips. He came to Austin quite a bit when I was there, and we brought him in a number of times to speak to the students and to speak to Allendale Baptist Church at that time. So I don't expect you to remember me.
Well, I thought you looked familiar. I think that was the early 80s, right?
Yes, the early 80s. Okay, let's talk about this book. I bought this book for our staff. We're going through it chapter by chapter, and your dad's chapter is the chapter we're in for today. I have staff meeting on Wednesdays. But how did this come about, and how did you choose the contributors that you chose?
Those are great questions. I first wrote a book called Apologetics for a New Generation. In 2009, it came out. And it was the same as this. I did the intro, and that one, I think I wrote a chapter, and then kind of brought a team together. And what really struck me then is that there's dozens and dozens of books on how to defend the Bible, intelligent design, cults and other religions, but very few on apologetic and evangelistic methodology. What do we do with this? So I wrote that in 2009 for a compilation book. It did really, really well. And then the publisher actually came back to me and said, hey, we'd like to update it and just shift the name to Apologetics for an Ever-Changing Culture. And then it was a matter of saying, all right, what topics are new? And when I say new topics, there's a difference in new strategies. Like, we didn't have a chapter in that book on how to do apologetics or evangelism online because it was just starting around that time.
Yeah.
There was a chapter on apologetics and mental health because we've seen that really explode. We added an interview on deconstruction. That's a big topic people are talking about.
Right.
And we also added a chapter on the new thought, which intersects with New Age, because that's become even bigger in our culture in the past few years. So it was a combination of what are new topics that haven't been covered that people need information on, and what are new strategies, and who's the best person to write it.
Yeah. So when you are you doing this on your own as far as going through, well, should I ask this guy or should I ask that guy? And how do you determine who's going to do what topic?
Well, I came up with a list, but I would go back and forth with the publisher. I also go online, certain apologetics Facebook groups at the time. I would just drop in there and go, hey, updating this book. Here's some different ideas I've thought about. Am I missing any chapters? And just get feedback from other people. Sometimes I'd send out something like a tweet and just say, hey, here's topics I'm thinking about. If you're going to cover apologetics today, what are the biggest topics? So I would talk to people. I talk to my students and just try to gather a sense of what are the biggest issues that need covering. And then, frankly, I just looked around myself with my relationships to figure out who would be the best person to write this. So in this lane, I look for people that had an interest in apologetics. I look for people that carry themselves in a certain fashion, because you might say you're platforming somebody by putting them in a book. Mm-hmm. And I look who's published and written and established. So it wasn't just a name game. I'm not interested in having recognizable names for the sake of recognizable names. I want this to be the most helpful book for people. Yeah. So who do I think is really practicing this and doing this and an expert in that area? Kind of piece those together and reach out. And I think everyone but one was able to do it.
Sean, when you put together something like this and you have a lot of authors, because you're an author and you've authored a number of books, do you find yourself being like, well, I wouldn't say it that way, and maybe I should have written this chapter? Do you run into a little bit of that?
You know, there's a couple chapters that I thought I could definitely write this. There's some that I couldn't, like the chapter on New Thought. Teaching apologetics in the church, I mean, I'm on the teaching staff at my church, but I really wanted a pastor to do that. So Derwin Gray wrote that for me. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there's probably a few chapters I could write, but part of this is we live in such a fractured age right now where there's so much division and competition within the church. And the more I could find different voices within the church and kind of say, you know what, people in this project might disagree on an issue here and there, which is fine, but we all agree on the importance of apologetics. We agree on the importance of unity. We agree on the gospel. That's why I wanted to include more people rather than try to write a number of different chapters myself.
Sean, what do you do if when you get the manuscript back from the person that you asked to write it, if there's some things in there you're like, I don't know if I agree completely with your premise? Did you run into some of that?
I had probably one or two chapters where it wasn't just like, this is heresy or this is outright wrong. It was just like, you know what, could you nuance this? Or would you be willing to add this? Or here's what a skeptic might say, and I don't know if they'd be satisfied with the response here. I wondered if you can expand it a little bit. So, you know, people, if you're clear up front, you typically get what you're looking for. Mm-hmm. And then I found most people, if you write back just graciously and say, hey, this love this part of it, I'm wondering if we could tweak this small section here and expand this, and because here's what people are thinking, and they would. I mean, there was one chapter with specifics, one that carried over from the first book, and there was something in the first book that was taken out, and I just went back and I was like, hey, is there any chance you can include this and cut this section? It's so good and so helpful. And everybody I asked to do that was more than willing to.
Okay, Sean, in the first book in 2009, was that you completely, or did you have a bunch of authors in that one too?
It was the same kind of thing. It was a compilation.
Okay. So how many authors carried over to the new one?
Oh, gosh. I would have to look at this and do the math.
I mean, was it it's changed quite a bit from the 2009 or?
Oh, I would say looking at it, maybe half of the authors just at first glance, but all of them that carried over, I asked to substantively update their essays. So there's probably maybe two in here that were not hugely updated because they're a little bit more timeless.
Yeah.
But like, for example, I can look at one right here that's on where's the topic right here? Oh, Defending Femininity, Why Jesus is Good News for Women. By Jonathan Grace Fincher. That is an incredible chapter. There's a few things she points out in this chapter that were game-changing to me, and it's kind of timeless. It's not like that really changes. So she went through it and made some adjustments and some tweaks and resent it. So there's probably one, two, three, maybe four that didn't have huge updates. And then there's probably half are completely new essays. And then some of the other chapters had pretty significant updates to them.
Okay, so I have to be honest. When I read your dad's chapter, just read it this morning. We're going to talk about it in staff meeting. The beginning is shocking, where he talks about going to the church and we preach the truth and only the truth. And he says to himself, and I guess he told the pastor, "You're never going to grow with that kind of a statement." And so it seems to me he did that on purpose to be kind of shocked value to get people's attention. Well, wait a minute. I thought we're supposed to preach the truth, speak the truth in love. Well, he really focuses on the love part. And if you just have truth and no love, you're a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. Now, was this the first time your dad in print has shared about what happened to him as a young boy?
Oh, I don't think it was the first time in print that he shared that. He shared what happened to him. We included that in the update to More Than a Carpenter in 2009.
Okay.
I don't know the answer to print. I remember when he started sharing it around that time. He had shared it with others, just not publicly. It was just a public secret, but not something he hadn't processed. But I don't recall if he included that in the first edition of Apologetics for New Generation or not. I'd have to go back and check on that one.
Yeah.
I would say in this chapter, you're right, it's shocking. But one thing to give context for it, it's about how relationships transform.
Right.
I kind of I live in multiple worlds, but sometimes I do stuff with youth ministries, and oftentimes they're so relational, they need to be reminded like doctrine and theology and apologetics as a whole. But then when I work in apologetics groups, and teachers and conferences, it's like truth need to be reminded, hey, there's a balance of relationships as
Yeah.
well. And so given that this is in an apologetics book, and you're right that my dad is he's a not an inappropriate provocateur, but he knows how to provoke people to
Yes.
remember and think, he put this in here in an apologetics book, assuming if we need to be pushed towards the balance of the scales one way or the other, it'd be towards relationships. But you don't have to convince somebody picking up an apologetics book that truth is important.
Yeah, well, I thought he did a masterful job in the chapter, although at first I was like, okay, Josh, I love
Yeah.
you, but I'm starting to see what happened to you over the years. I thought it was where I read, I guess it's in the book or I might have read it online. He has authored or co-authored 165 books. Is that right, Sean?
Yes, that is correct. And he has mastered like writing one book evidence and then every conceivable derivative, like children demands a verdict and one for teenagers and a parenting version. So he's just mastered the ability, which in part counts for 160, but you start going down the list, the amount he's produced is just about superhuman.
That's man, that's something. Now, does he, just curious, does he enjoy writing more than speaking, or is it equal?
So he's actually stepped back. He's just retired and he's doing okay, but for health reasons, he just doesn't have the energy and ability to do what he did. So for about the past year or two, he's kind of stepped back. But I would say speaking comes much more naturally to him. He loves to research, Jeff. I mean, he loves it. I remember he would just sit, he would like get excited when he would have boxes of research to just analyze it, think about it, and digest. He got excited by that. But he would often say, he goes, I can speak. God's given me that ability, but I'm not as good of a writer as like Lee Strobel or something like that. And he would say that, not like a comparison game, but he just was like, I have to work at it. And it doesn't come as naturally to me. Speaking, I think he just stepped on stage and just owned it.
Yes. Well, we're talking to Dr. Sean McDowell, and the book is called Apologetics for an Ever-Changing Culture. You're listening to Real Truth for Today. Pastor Jeff Shreve here. We'll be right back after the break.
Hey friends, it's Jessica Peck, doctor, nurse, mama, as your 1 minute parenting coach. Do you feel pressure in today's world to be a perfect parent? We feel like if we don't have our kids in the honors program or in select sports or wearing the latest fashions, we are somehow failing them. The truth is, our kids don't want perfect parents, even if that were possible. They want present parents. Are you physically in your child's presence every day? And when you are you emotionally present? Are you living in the moment? Are you making eye contact for 20 seconds or more? Are you listening with your whole face and attention? When you feel badly about your child not having something, remember that truly the thing they want most is you. I'll see you on the Dr. Nurse Mama radio show on American Family Radio.
The Middle East, that's one part of the world we need to pay attention to, especially the country of Israel. Each week, I'll help you make sense of what's happening in that region through a biblical lens. I'll bring you important information about security threats, archaeological discoveries, biblical prophecy, ministries happening on the ground, and much more. I'm John Riley. Join me for the Middle East Report Special Edition every Saturday at 6:30 p.m. Central on American Family Radio as I connect you to the people, places, and geography of what we read in God's Word.
All of chapter 4 through 19 has to do with what God is going to do when he pours out his wrath upon the earth. The church won't be here. The church will be in heaven. How do we know that? We just looked in through the door and the church is up there already.
Dr. David Jeremiah continues his series in Revelation, Escape the Coming Night, next time on Turning Point.
5:30 a.m. and 7 p.m. Central on American Family Radio.
You could be a part of our first ever Weekend with AFA, Thursday, October 2nd through Saturday, October 4th in Tupelo, Mississippi.
Our Weekend with AFA event in October is going to be a chance to meet AFA supporters in person.
We'll have tours, fellowship, special speakers, and more.
I'll do some stand-up comedy, Abe will do some preaching, and I'm really excited about it.
It's a Weekend with AFA, Thursday, October 2nd through Saturday, October 4th in Tupelo, Mississippi. Speakers will include Abraham Hamilton III, Jenna Ellis, Tim Barton, Tim Wildman, and more.
I am thoroughly looking forward to our Weekend with AFA coming up in October, where we're going to be able to meet our supporters like yourself, the fellowship, to visit our facilities here in Tupelo, and to have everyone come together for a wonderful weekend.
That's October 2nd through 4th. It's a Weekend with AFA, and we hope you can join us. Register at afa.net/weekend. That's afa.net/weekend.
This is Real Truth for Today. Podcasts of the program are available on the podcast page at afr.net. Now, back to Pastor Jeff Shreve.
Welcome back to the program. Pastor Jeff here talking to Dr. Sean McDowell. We're talking about his brand new book where he is the general editor, Apologetics for an Ever-Changing Culture, a biblical and culturally relevant approach to talking about God. You know, the Bible commands us in 1 Peter chapter 3 that we're always to be ready to make a defense. That's what apologetics is, defending the faith, to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you, yet with gentleness and reverence. So we are commanded as believers to speak the truth in love. I want to get into this with you, but Jesus was full of grace and truth. He's full of, I've always kind of looked at it, you know, loving kindness is a word used in the Old Testament over and over and over again, but there's not really an equivalent in the New Testament other than, I think, the word grace, which is used so much time in the New Testament. But Jesus is full of grace and truth. He's full of loving kindness and truth. And he's not half and half. They're both full. And so really, just like with your dad's chapter 3 in the book, it is about grace and truth, about love and truth. And that seems to be a difficult one for people because we tend to fall, just I think naturally in our makeup, we tend to fall on a more mercy-oriented, more love, grace-oriented. The truth maybe gets minimized, or I'm heavy truth. And you don't see that play out in compassion and mercy. Talk about that in terms of today's witness to the world.
I think you're right about that. I've been actually reading the Gospel of John daily in its entirety if I can, and it's been transformative, Jeff. And it says right away in John, it says, you know, the law came through God the Father, but grace and truth through Jesus Christ. Today, as always, we need grace and love and kindness, and we need truth. There's never been a time where we just needed one and not the other. Mm-hmm. In fact, by the way, I think we still need certain people who have a more prophetic, truth-focused voice, and some who have what we might consider, some would call it like a pastoral kind of gracious voice. We need both of those. And you're right, we err on one side or the other. A couple of things that I would say to balance this is, number one, you're going to have to live in that tension to a degree. Mm-hmm. And if we're not living in that tension, we're probably leaning in too strong to one side or the other. There's some really difficult situations today with sexuality and relationships where sometimes people ask me and I'm like, whew, is this a hill to die on or not? So you're just going to live in that tension somewhat to speak, which I think is healthy. But I often ask myself, is this a central core issue that I should die on? Because I think there's a lot of people who might die on a secondary issue and not show grace. And I think, you know, I think this is an issue where well-meaning Christians can differ. Make your case, be strong and be firm, but you can still be gracious in how you do so. And I honestly think this is one of the most powerful things we have as Christians today, is because everybody's yelling, everybody's shouting, people are canceling, they're trying to provoke to get attention. And when Christians have a calmness and a kindness about them, it kind of speaks volumes that I actually think draws attention to what we believe.
You know, Sean, you're talking about reading the Gospel of John. I think that's great. I would challenge myself to do that and challenge our listeners. Even if you can't do it, read the whole 21 chapters, you know, every day, you could make that a goal to, I'm going to read this through every, you know, in the week. I'm reading through the Gospel of John, one of the greatest, you know, books of the Bible. When you think about the Gospel of John and how the Lord's approach was different with different people, so John 3 with Nicodemus, his approach is one way. John 4 with the woman at the well, his approach is another way. Unpack that a little bit, if you would. Why was Jesus more straightforward, let's say, with Nicodemus, you know, telling him point blank, you're not going to go to heaven unless you're born again, as opposed to how he was not coy, but he was more, I don't know what the right word would be. He's leading with living water, and then he's going into, well, go call your husband. So what do you see the differences there?
Well, I don't know that Jesus had a blanket evangelistic strategy that he applied to every single situation every time. Mm-hmm. He used wisdom, and I think he understood what questions are people asking, what barriers do they really have, and how do I reach them where they're at? So Nicodemus comes to him alone at night, right? You see this theme in the Gospel of John of people who fear the religious leaders. Even the blind man who's healed in John 9, his parents don't say they know that Jesus did him for fear of the religious leaders at that time. That theme comes through a lot. So when it's just Jesus and Nicodemus, who's a religious leader, who's teaching people, and clearly if he's in that position, he can take it and he needs to know and is having influence, Jesus is going to shoot straight with him. And you get the impression that's what Nicodemus wants. But now it's not only a Samaritan, but a woman at a well, and Jesus is alone. She's had four husbands, and the one she's with now is her fifth. Jesus seems to handle the situation a little bit more tenderly, let's just say. And it works because she realizes he's a prophet, and then she goes and tells, you know, everybody. There's obviously some hyperbole going on. She goes and tells everybody, and then he goes and spends 2 days with Samaria to hear him themselves, and as a result, many believe. But then you also go one chapter forward, John 5, and then you skip into like John 8. Jesus is brutal with some of the religious leaders publicly. I mean, he calls them liars. He calls them their father is Satan. because right. they're not coming to him with questions trying to figure things out. They're trying to disprove him. They're trying to shame him. They're mm-hmm. saying to him distinctly, you're born in sexual immorality. And mm-hmm. Jesus doesn't back down and tell a parable. He goes right at them. Mm-hmm. And so we see this side of Jesus at times that is bold and clear and speaks truth. He's not just trying to win a crowd. And then you go one chapter forward in John 6, and he's like, you need to eat my flesh and drink my blood. Right. And it's like, what is he saying? This is the opposite of a pro-growth strategy.
Yes.
And his disciples are like, offended. Some of them leave. And then he says to Peter, and I always wonder the tone of this. He's like, will you leave too? Mm-hmm. And I wonder if it was like a sadness that was there mm-hmm. or a challenge that was there. And Peter's like, where are we going to go? Mm-hmm. So Jesus spoke truth clearly at times and was not afraid to offend people if he had to. But he had this kind, soft edge to people as well when that was necessary for them to receive the word.
Yeah, I remember my pastor, DeMond Shook, told me, he said, notice how Jesus, he's harsh with the religious crowd and the religious leaders. He said, you don't read about him being harsh with the Syrophoenician woman or the woman at the well or the woman caught in adultery. You know, he's very gracious to those people, the woman that weeps at his feet, the prostitute in Luke 7. And I can't think of any passage where Old Testament passages, God is pretty rough on the Gentiles, but Jesus wasn't. And it seems like those people had the knowledge that they were sinners. They didn't have to be convinced of that. They knew they were far from God, whereas the Jews felt like, hey, we're good. We have Abraham for our father, and, you know, as they argue with him in John 8. Can you think of any passage, Sean, where the Lord was maybe harsh like that with a Gentile?
None is coming to mind, but we just don't have a lot of instances of Jesus interacting with Gentiles because he is first to the Jews and then the Gentiles. So those who come to him, you know, as far as I can think off the top of my head, already have a sense of who he is, are already desperate for need. And so they're in a different situation. I wish we had Jesus doing an evangelistic message explicitly to Gentiles or leaving, you know, kind of Judea and going somewhere else to see how he would engage them. Mm-hmm. I mean, Paul, I know it's not Jesus, but Paul in Acts 17 is clearly engaging, you know, Gentiles there, and he builds common ground. He clarifies the differences between their gods and his God. Mm-hmm. And then he challenges them pretty boldly. He mm-hmm. speaks out boldly. He doesn't, you know, attack them in the way Jesus did in John 8, but it's just a very different circumstance. So it's hard to draw certain conclusions about Jesus and Gentiles, as far as I can tell, from the limited number that we have.
Yeah. Good point. Okay, let me ask you this, Sean. When you do a work like this and you involve so many authors, there's always the danger that somebody goes off the rails, and then the book becomes like, uh-oh. And I thought you and your dad did a masterful interview about Ravi Zacharias a few years ago, and I sent that out to all my staff. I said, listen to this. This was great. And, what do you do? I was telling my engineer, I said, I still go to some of Ravi's explanations for things. You know, he had a ton of YouTube videos where he's on college campuses. The truth of that doesn't change, even though the messenger, you know, it was exposed as you weren't living this out. Is that, when you put together a book like that, is that a danger that you, or a sense of like, that you feel?
It is. And, you know, making sense of what happened to Ravi, we've all got to land in different places and make sense of it in different ways. For me, I would not use his resources at all. You're absolutely right. Truth is the truth and doesn't change. And he really was a remarkable speaker on stage, but I don't trust him at all. Mm-hmm. He was a liar. He clearly didn't just fall short. I mean, to the end, as far as we know, never repented of what he had done wrong that just profoundly and evilly hurt people. So I don't trust any story that he tells right. at all. I just don't consider him a reliable source. I've had to take a handful of interviews down of people that stuff comes out afterwards, and I go, well, okay, you know, this needs to be taken down. I just did recently. I took one down. Mm-hmm. And so I do my best to vet people before a project like this.
Yeah.
If it comes out that one of them, I don't know, leaves their faith or abuses somebody or becomes a heretic, I would just do my best to take it down and contact the publisher and make a statement about it. So that's a risk that's out mm-hmm. there, you know, unfortunately. And the older I get and the more people I tend to work with, the more it kind of just happens. But I'm not going to stop working with people that I think do good work because I just think we're called to do so. I mean, this interview, if I became the next Ravi and I'm not going to, you would have to consider taking it down. You know, you're platforming me right now. So yeah. We're all kind of together in a sense.
Yeah. Not to beat a dead horse on Ravi, but sure. How do you, I'm trying to remember what you and your dad said about this because the question comes into play. Okay, is this guy really a believer? I never heard him say anything that I thought this is heretical. He, you know, he wasn't connected to a church. He's just kind of floating out there. And I know that John MacArthur said, you know, that's a concern. If you're just an apologetics guy, but you're not really attached to the local church with the accountability of a local church and those kinds of things. But how do you view somebody like that? Obviously, we can't see his heart, but from everything that we could read and hear about him, he sounded like he was a true believer, but then all this stuff comes out.
You know, he did. I mean, I can't remember anything that was bad theologically or false that he said. I mean, I haven't gone back to read his stuff, but I don't remember that. But, you know, what comes to my mind is, look, even demons have perfect theology.
Right.
They just do. So that, I mean, that's a necessary test, but not sufficient that somebody is saved. And I think the last thing he said I would land on, I don't know his heart. I mean, it does say in John, you know, if you love me, you'll continue in the word. If you're mm-hmm. a follower of mine, you'll continue in the word. He was not living it and continued to not live it secretly, as far as we know, to the end of his life. Mm-hmm. So could he have been saved amidst that? Yeah, I don't know his heart. I can't judge it. Mm-hmm. But would I be shocked if he never knew the Lord personally? No, I wouldn't be shocked at all, given what I've read and studied. I mean, I'd encourage people to, I actually think that's about as just sharp and remarkable as my dad has ever been in an interview. Mm-hmm. He didn't want the questions ahead of time. I'm like, are you sure this is really important, Dad? He goes, no, I've thought about this. And I thought he just nailed it. I was so proud of him. So I appreciate that you shared that. I'd encourage people even today to go back and take a look at it. There was just so much wisdom. But you know what it says in 1 Samuel 16 that man judged the outward appearance, but God judges the heart.
Right.
He is standing before his creator. And if he didn't repent, it's not going to be pretty.
Mm. Yeah, that's fear-producing for sure. You know, knowing the fear of the Lord, we persuade men. That's what it says in 2 Corinthians 5:11. Mm-hmm. After it says, for we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ. You know, I've always viewed, Sean, the judgment seat of Christ as, you know, that's where we are rewarded. It's not where the Lord evaluates us to see if we go to heaven or not. But it is something that should produce fear in us that we are going to give an account of how we lived. Well, I'm talking to Sean McDowell, Dr. Sean McDowell, Apologetics for an Ever-Changing Culture. And I got to put my glasses on again, Sean. That's what happens when you get older. A biblical and culturally relevant approach to talking about God. This is a great book. We're going through it as a staff. I want to encourage pastors, pick up a copy of this because it makes for great conversation in your staff meeting. We just always read a chapter and then we discuss it. So I encourage you to do that. And you're listening to Real Truth for Today. Pastor Jeff Shreve here. We are up against a break, but we will be back in 3 minutes with more Sean McDowell. Don't go away.
If we lose this cultural war, we're going to have a hedonistic, humanistic society.
Discover the story of the culture warrior, Don Wildman, and how he went head-to-head with Hollywood, Playboy, the homosexual agenda, and the Disney empire. The movement Don started paved the way for Christians to boldly stand for truth and righteousness in a hostile culture. Watch Culture Warrior today for free. Visit culturewarrior.movie.
The loss of a child through abortion, miscarriage, or stillbirth affects the emotional health of families. Feelings of anger, sadness, and regret can be overwhelming. There is hope and healing in the aftermath of a reproductive loss. Call the International Helpline at 866-482-LIFE to talk with someone who has been where you are and healed to help others. Your call is confidential. 866-482-LIFE.
The following is not an actor, but a real-life story from Trinity Debt Management.
I'm Claire from Trinity Debt Management. I'm a counselor, and the reason that I love working for Trinity is because I get to help folks with one of the hardest problems a family can face, and that's financial difficulties. In this day and age, everything is going up. You have higher utilities, higher grocery bills, higher fuel, and those credit card interest rates have gone up as well. We can help you with that. We can help you get lower interest rates, lower monthly payments. In just a few minutes, we put together a plan that gets you out of debt and keeps you out of debt. I love my job. It's a great program and a very smart way to find debt relief.
If credit card debt has you down, call Trinity at 1-800-788-1813.
I'm Claire, a Trinity counselor. Call me and become debt-free for keeps.
1-800-788-1813.
They're craving Bibles in Africa. This is Bible League International, and here in America, you and I as believers can open our Bibles every day and be reminded of God's precious promises. But in Africa, the part of the world where Christianity is growing in the greatest numbers, as many as 9 of 10 new believers in many countries like South Africa and Ghana are denied God's Word. And while many of those are adults, you know, many are just children wanting to know what it means to grow as Christians.
My name is Wendell, and I live in Kenya, Africa. I learned a Bible verse in Sunday school and I want to learn more. Please send me a Bible today.
Right now, through the end of June, Bible League and American Family Radio are teamed up to bless 16,000 Bible-less believers in Africa, and that includes 10-year-old Wendell. $5 sends a Bible, $100 sends 20, $500 sends 100. Would you pray and call 800-YES-WORD? 800-YES-WORD. 800-YES-WORD or give it sendbiblesnow.org. sendbiblesnow.org.
If you'd like to contact Pastor Jeff, email pastorjeff@fromhisheart.org. Now, back to Real Truth for Today with Pastor Jeff Shreve.
Welcome back to the program. Pastor Jeff here. We're talking to Dr. Sean McDowell. The book is called Apologetics for an Ever-Changing Culture, and Sean is the general editor, 23, I think they're 23, if I counted correctly, authors in this book. And a great book, A Biblical and Culturally Relevant Approach to Talking About God. A great study for church staffs, because we need to be able to talk in terms that the culture understands. You know, one of the things, Sean, when I first came to First Baptist Texarkana in 2003, I had been taught by my pastor, Damon Shook, a statement from Billy Graham: you're anchored to the Word, but you're changing with the times in terms of how you communicate the Word. And he likened it to a missionary. If I go to a country in Africa, well, it's really important for me to know not only the language, but the culture, because I can say something or do something that is going to be very off-putting without even knowing, because they don't share my culture. Let me ask you this. One of the things we had talked a little bit off camera, but Andy Stanley wrote a book called Deep and Wide, and it sold a lot of copies. And it was basically saying, you know, if we would do church the way Jesus, if we would preach the way Jesus preached, our churches couldn't hold the amount of people that would come, and we would be, I don't think he's very deep, but very wide. What was your opinion of that book?
So I haven't actually read that book. I'm not a pastor at a local church, so I didn't I don't track with kind of church growth type strategies. Mm-hmm. Been familiar with Andy Stanley for a long time. The one deep dive that I did, and this was last fall, he had that conference at his church, and I was going to go, but the fall before last, I was going to go, but I had some health issues, and a friend of mine went to just view this church, the event, and I did a deep dive on my YouTube channel, and I think he's moved from just trying to be kind and gracious towards the LGBTQ community, mm-hmm. but has abandoned a biblical view of sexuality and tried to affirm a third way. Mm-hmm. So I think that ties to somewhat. Now there's a little more clarity when he was talking about unhitching the Old Testament.
Right.
At first I was like, well, you know, maybe apologetically, he just wants to focus on Jesus. Like, I get it. Now looking back, I go, you know what? Yeah, we got to preach like Jesus. But like you said, anchored to the word as a whole, because Jesus was anchored to the word as a whole. So can't give you commentary on that book, but some of the directions he's gone definitely concerns me.
Well, I was thinking too, Sean, in terms of apologetics, so a Christian one-on-one, you know, the term I use all the time on this program is shine and share, those two terms. The Christian life is how you live, shine, and then what comes out of your mouth. We're to share the good news. And if you don't shine, it's kind of like your dad's chapter. If you're not shining, your share has no power because you just come across as a hypocrite. But if you're not sharing, people oftentimes they need more. You know, the old expression, well, share the gospel and use words if necessary. Well, the gospel needs words. I mean, it comes to us in words. So both of those fit together, and that's speaking the truth in love. You know, there has to come a point in time. So as a Christian shares his or her faith, just like Jesus with the woman at the well, that's probably a better template for believers when they share with people at work and things like that. You know, we talk about what Jesus offers us, forgiveness, but there has to come a go call your husband moment. And so share a little bit about that as we defend the faith, and as we don't want to come across holier than thou or beating them over the head with truth, how do you bridge that subject about, now let's talk about your sin?
Well, I think you're right to point towards John 4 as a good example, because Jesus asks a lot of questions in his engagement. And by the way, in the Gospels and Acts, there's 340 questions that Jesus asks. In the letters of Paul, there's 262. In the Bible as a whole, there's 3,000 questions. So the God who made our brains and relates to us, number one, tells stories. The Bible is a big story. It's full of stories. And number two, asks questions. So if you just watch Jesus, I always ask myself, why did he ask this question at this time? What's the brilliance of this question? And so I ask, even though I'm an apologist, I ask a lot more questions than I do make statements. But every conversation, I don't feel like I have to get to sin and challenge somebody to convert. Personally, I don't. I follow more the model of Greg Kokel in his book Tactics, when he talks about putting stone in somebody's shoe. And when you have a stone in your shoe, it bugs you later on until you get rid of it, take your shoe off and empty it. A lot of conversations, I just want to make somebody think. But I'm oftentimes paying attention if I sense that this person is open to spiritual things, if this person wants to talk about Jesus. I believe when it's all said and done, the biggest barrier is sin. It's idolatry. You know, the heart of the problem is the problem of the heart. So I'm going to challenge people at some point and say, hey, you have these intellectual questions, but what's holding you back? If Jesus is right, he says there's something in the heart that's holding us back. Look in Mark 7, and you also see all throughout the Gospel of John. So is there a sin issue holding you back? I mean, there's a time and place to do it. I just don't think every conversation on an airplane or a bus or walking along, I have to get there. But in the back of my mind, I'm always hoping to get there if somebody's open to it.
Sean, how do you view, I know there's much that has been said, the last 10, 20 years about, Bill Bright's, the four spiritual laws that has been reprinted billions of times. That's what I was introduced to in college. That's what we shared. God loves you and has a wonderful plan for your life. Law one, law two, he gets into sin. You know, we're separated from God's love. There are people today that say that's not a good way to witness. And then you have Ray Comfort, The Way of the Master, which I do think that's in our day and age where people think they're okay. I saw a study that said, even 61% of people believe in hell and 0.5% of people believe they're going there. So we see that we're the good people.
Of course.
How do you see that today in terms of evangelism and apologetics?
Well, one response is to say that clearly the four spiritual laws works. Mm-hmm. Obviously it does. I mean, there's no pragmatic level. Not that that's a great theological argument, but it works. I think the brilliance of it is that it's like, here's four laws. You can remember it and apply it in different situations in conversations with people. That's what I think is the brilliance about the four laws. I do have, the first law, I get it when it was written, God loves you and has a wonderful plan for your life. But I think Ray has clearly raised some fair questions about this. And he's talked about like what it cost the apostles to follow after Jesus. I did my dissertation on the deaths of the apostles. Was Peter really crucified upside down? Was Bartholomew flayed alive? Did Thomas die by spears in India? Mm-hmm. And so I studied this probably as much as anybody who's ever lived, written an academic book on it. And it's pretty clear in the early church, even just read Acts. If you proclaim Jesus, it's not this wonderful life that you get from a human perspective. Mm-hmm. You get a wonderful life spiritually, but they were mocked. They were thrown in prison. Mm-hmm. They were beaten. Some of them were killed. Mm-hmm. So I guess the concern that's raised is when it says God has a wonderful plan for your life, that is true. But the way that's heard is not necessarily what God means by a wonderful mm-hmm. plan in life. So if you're going to say that, you better very carefully clarify what sin is, what that means, and what Jesus meant by pick up your cross and follow after me.
Yeah, good point. Okay, so what about those stories about Peter crucified upside down? And
so I think, I studied the 12 disciples, and then I added James, the brother of Jesus, and the apostle Paul. Mm-hmm. Of those 14, I think there's four that we have high or solid historical evidence died as martyrs, both James, Paul, and Peter. I think there's two that are at least 51% more probable than not, Andrew and Thomas, but it's weaker, later evidence. Mm-hmm. Honestly, historically speaking, Jeff, I don't think we know what happened where history ends and tradition begins mm-hmm. with the other apostles after that, the other eight. Now, Peter being crucified upside down, that first appears at the end of the second century, in a document called the Acts of Peter. It's an apocryphal account. Mm-hmm. And I think it's then picked up in like 230 in the third century by church historians start referring to it. But if you actually read the first account, I think it's really making more of a theological point that the world is upside down and Peter sees it clearly when he's upside down. And his death will help turn things right side up, kind of like Jesus is. Mm-hmm. So records of people being crucified upside down, but I'm not even certain. I think Peter died as a martyr. John 21 is clear. Mm-hmm. And other sources, there's 10 sources, first and second century. But when it comes to him being crucified, one thing we know about crucifixion is crucified victims were almost always stripped bare to humiliate and shame them.
Right.
In John 21, Jesus says to Peter, he says, you will be taken where you do not want to go, and you will be clothed by another. Well, wait a minute. If crucifixion is done in the bare, what does it mean that he would be clothed? So I don't think he was crucified upside down. And by the way, last question. Do you think that, you know, the typical story is Peter didn't want to die the way Jesus did. He didn't consider himself worthy. Well, you know, do you think the Romans took suggestions on how people wanted to be crucified? Probably not, right?
I would say no, yes. Yeah, that's a good, great point. Great point. Sean, real quick, with the time remaining, so I have not gotten to read this chapter yet, but it really intrigues me. Emotionally Healthy Apologetics, Understanding Our Ways of Finding Meaning and Truth. Give us a little thumbnail of that chapter.
That is one of the best chapters, I think, that's really fresh by Mark Matlock. And one of the things he pointed out is we have relativism that's so prevalent in our culture today. And a piece of that is intellectual. A piece of that is the worldview that people have imbibed and heard and picked up in our culture. But he makes an argument how deeply our belief systems are shaped by our relationships and our lack thereof. And he suggests that maybe some of this moral relativism kind of revolution is driven by broken community and broken relationships, and that there might be a relational component to what people believe or don't believe about truth. And I think there might be something to that. So if we want to change someone's views about relativism, we've got to point out the flaws in that, why it's mistaken, and there's objective truth. Mm-hmm. But there's also some healthy relationships that need to get built so that truth can be accepted and received. That's the truth balance that he's going for. Mm-hmm. In the chapter. And I think it's absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, that makes me think of Rosaria Butterfield. You know, that, I mean, that's her testimony. Of course, your dad's testimony is the same.
Right.
It wasn't just him researching the truth. It was the love that those people showed him that really brought him across the finish line. Well, Sean, in just a couple of minutes left, what do you want people to walk away with after they read Apologetics for an Ever-Changing Culture?
You know what? Two things. Number one, you're using it, and I'm really impressed, Jeff, exactly like I would hope churches and Christian schools and small groups would. Let's read this chapter. Let's discuss it. Let's debate it. Let's take what's helpful. That's the idea. It's a how-to book. Mm-hmm. How do we actually do apologetics? How do we do evangelism? So people might not use every single chapter, but everybody can use multiple chapters and be better online, be better in their family, be better, you know, fill in the blank. So it's just to give people confidence and tools to better share their faith and engage others.
Yeah. I love the way it does challenge, just like your dad's chapter. It challenges us to step back and say, well, wait a minute, am I thinking about this correctly, or am I just so locked in to we preach the truth and the truth only that I'm not seeing these other things are important? How we come across, you know, the first chapter, how you say what you say matters, because
right.
we can really turn people off. Well, Sean, how can our listeners connect with you?
So my website probably links to everything else, seanmcdowell.org, but I'm on Instagram. I'm on Twitter/X. I really love YouTube, just long form apologetics conversation. So many of the topics in this book and guests I've had on, I talk about near-death experiences, evidence for the Bible, evidence for the resurrection. I have a lot of skeptics on and kind of model actually how to do this with people. So that'd be a great place too.
All right. Well, Sean, thanks so much for being my guest. The book is called Apologetics for an Ever-Changing Culture. I encourage you to pick up a copy. Thanks for listening to Real Truth for Today. Pastor Jeff Shreve here. I'll be with you again tomorrow. Go out today, shine for Christ, and share what great things the Lord has done for you, and God will use you as his witness. God bless you.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.